decided. He was neutral in the first war of gods and titans, but Kronos has convinced him to fight. This is, well, it's not a good sign. Oceanus would not commit unless he was sure he could pick the winning side.
He looks stupid, I said, trying to sound upbeat. I mean, who fights with a snake?
Daddy will tie it in knots,
Tyson said firmly. Poseidon smiled, but he looked weary.
I appreciate your faith. We have been at war almost a year now. My powers are taxed, and still he finds new forces to throw at me. Sea monsters so ancient I'd forgotten about them.
I heard an explosion in the distance. About half a mile away, a mountain of coral disintegrated under the weight of two giant creatures. I could dimly make out their shapes. One was a lobster, the other was a giant humanoid like a cyclops, but he was surrounded by a flurry of limbs. At first, I thought he was wearing a bunch of giant octopi. Then, I realized they were his own arms, 100 flailing, fighting arms. Briaris, I said. I was happy to see him, but he looked like he was fighting for his life. He was the last of his kind, 100-handed one, cousin of the Cyclopes. We'd saved him from Kronos' prison last summer, and I knew he'd come to help Poseidon, but I hadn't heard of him since.
He fights well, Poseidon said. I wish we had a whole army like him, but he is the only one.
I watched as Briaris bellowed in rage and picked up the lobster, which thrashed and snapped its pincers. He threw it off the coral mountain, and the lobster disappeared into the darkness. Briaris swam after it, his 100 arms spinning like the blades of a motorboat.
Percy, we may not have much time, my dad said. Tell me of your mission. Did you see Kronos?
I told him everything, though my voice choked up when I explained about Beckendorf. I looked down at the courtyards below and saw hundreds of wounded mermen lying on makeshift cots. I saw rows of coral mounds that must have been hastily made graves. I realized Beckendorf wasn't the first death. He was only one of hundreds, maybe thousands. I'd never felt so angry and helpless. Poseidon stroked his beard.
Percy, Beckendorf chose a heroic death. You bear no blame for that. Kronos' army will be in disarray. Many were destroyed.
But we didn't kill him, did we? As I said it, I knew it was a naive hope. We might blow up his ship and disintegrate his monsters, but a Titan lord wouldn't be so easy to kill.
No, Poseidon admitted, but you've bought our side some time.
There were demigods on that ship, I said, thinking of the kid I'd seen in the stairwell. Somehow, I'd allow myself to concentrate on the monsters in Kronos. I'd convinced myself that destroying their ship was all right because they were evil. They were sailing to attack my city, and besides, they couldn't really be permanently killed. Monsters just vaporized and reformed eventually, but demigods? Poseidon put his hand on my shoulder.
Percy, there were only a few demigod warriors aboard that ship, and they all chose to battle for Kronos. Perhaps some heeded your warning and escaped. If they did not, they chose their path.
They were brainwashed, I said. Now they're dead, and Kronos is still alive. That's supposed to make me feel better? I glared at the mosaic. Little tile explosions destroying tile monsters. It seemed so easy when it was just a picture. Tyson put his arm around me. If anybody else had tried that, I would have pushed him away. But Tyson was too big and stubborn. He hugged me whether I wanted it or not.
Not your fault, brother. Kronos does not explode good. Next time, we will use a big stick.
Percy,
my father said, Beckendorf's sacrifice wasn't in vain. You have scattered the invasion force. New York will be safe for a time, which frees the other Olympians to deal with the bigger threat.
The bigger threat? I thought about what the Golden Titan had said in my dream. The gods have answered the challenge. Soon they will be destroyed.
A shadow passed over my father's face. You've had enough sorrow for one day. Ask Chiron when you return to camp.
Return to camp? But you're in trouble here. I want to help.
You can't, Percy. Your job is elsewhere.
I couldn't believe I was hearing this. I looked at Tyson for backup. My brother chewed his lip.
Daddy, Percy can fight with a sword. He is good.
I know that,
Poseidon said gently. Dad, I can help, I said. I know I can. You're not going to hold out here much longer.
A fireball launched into the sky from behind the enemy lines. I thought Poseidon would deflect it or something, but it landed on the outer corner of the yard and exploded, sending mermen tumbling through the water. Poseidon winced as if he'd just been stabbed.
Return to camp, he insisted, and tell Chiron it is time.
For what?
You must hear the prophecy, the entire prophecy.
I didn't need to ask him which prophecy. I had been hearing about the great prophecy for years, but nobody would ever tell me the whole thing. All I knew was that I was supposed to make a decision that would decide the fate of the world, but no pressure.
What if this is the decision? I said. Staying here to fight or leaving? What if I leave and you...
I couldn't say die. Gods weren't supposed to die, but I'd seen it happen. Even if they didn't die, they could be reduced to nearly nothing, exiled, imprisoned in the depths of Tartarus like Kronos had been.
Percy, you must go, Poseidon insisted. I don't know what your final decision will be, but your fight lies in the world above. If nothing else, you must warn your friends at camp. Kronos knew your plans. You have a spy. We will hold here. We have no choice.
Tyson gripped my hand desperately.
I will miss you, brother.
Watching us, our father seemed to age another 10 years.
Tyson, you have work to do as well, my son. They need you in the armory.
Tyson pouted some more.
I will go,
he sniffled. He hugged me so hard he almost cracked my ribs.
Percy, be careful. Do not let monsters kill you dead.
I tried to nod confidently, but it was too much for the big guy. He sobbed and swam away toward the armory, where his cousins were fixing spears and swords.
You should let him fight, I told my father. He hates being stuck in the armory, can't you tell?
Poseidon shook his head.
It is bad enough I must send you into danger. Tyson is too young. I must protect him.
You should trust him, I said. Not try to protect him. Poseidon's eyes flared. I thought I'd gone too far, but then he looked down at the mosaic and his shoulders sagged. On the tiles, the mermaid guy in the crawfish chariot was coming closer to the palace.
Oceanus approaches, my father said. I must meet him in battle.
I'd never been scared for a god before, but I didn't see how my dad could face this titan and win.
I will hold, Poseidon promised. I will not give up my domain. Just tell me, Percy, do you still have the birthday gift I gave you last summer?
I nodded and pulled out my camp necklace. It had a bead for every summer I'd been at Camp Half-Blood, but since last year, I'd also kept a sand dollar on the cord. My father had given it to me for my 15th birthday. He'd told me I would know when to spend it, but so far, I hadn't figured out what he meant. All I knew was that it didn't fit the vending machines in the school cafeteria.
"The time is coming," he promised. "With luck, I will see you for your birthday next week, and we will have a proper celebration."
He smiled, and for a moment, I saw the old light in his eyes. Then, the entire sea grew dark in front of us, like an inky storm was rolling in. Thunder crackled, which should have been impossible underwater. A huge icy presence was approaching. I sensed a wave of fear roll through the armies below us.
"I must assume my true godly form," Poseidon said. "Go, and good luck, my son."
I wanted to encourage him, to hug him or something, but knew better than to stick around. When a god assumes his true form, the power is so great that any mortal looking on him will disintegrate. "Goodbye, father," I managed. Then I turned away. I willed the ocean currents to aid me. Water swirled around me, and I shot toward the surface at speeds that would have caused any normal human to pop like a balloon. When I looked back, all I could see were flashes of green and blue as my father fought the Titan, and the sea itself was torn apart by the two armies. Chapter 3. I get a sneak peek at my death. If you want to be popular at Camp Half-Blood, don't come back from a mission with bad news. Word of my arrival spread as soon as I walked out of the ocean. Our beach is on the north shore of Long Island, and it's enchanted, so most people can't even see it. People don't just appear on the beach unless they're demigods or gods or really, really lost pizza delivery guys. It's happened, but that's another story. Anyway, that afternoon, the lookout on duty was Connor Stoll from the Hermes cabin. When he spotted me, he got so excited he fell out of his tree. Then he blew the conch horn to signal the camp and ran to greet me. Connor had a crooked smile that matched his crooked sense of humor. He's a pretty nice guy, but you should always keep one hand on your wallet when he's around, and do not, under any circumstances, give him access to shaving cream unless you want to find your sleeping bag full of it. He's got curly brown hair and is a little shorter than his brother Travis, which is the only way I can tell them apart. They are both so unlike my old enemy Luke, it's hard to believe they're all sons of Hermes.
"Percy!" he yelled. "What happened? Where's Beckendorf?"
Then he saw my expression, and his smile melted.
"Oh no, poor Selena. Holy Zeus, when she finds out..."
Together we climbed the sand dunes. A few hundred yards away, people were already streaming toward us, smiling and excited.
"Percy's back," they were probably thinking. "He saved the day. Maybe he brought souvenirs."
I stopped at the dining pavilion and waited for them. No sense rushing down there to tell them what a loser I was. I gazed across the valley and tried to remember how Camp Half-Blood looked the first time I ever saw it. That seemed like a bajillion years ago. From the dining pavilion, you could see pretty much everything. Hills ringed the valley. On the tallest, Half-Blood Hill, Thalia's pine tree stood with the golden fleece hanging from its branches, magically protecting the camp from its enemies. The guard dragon Peleus was so big now, I could see him from here, curled around the tree trunk, sending up smoke signals as he snored. To my right spread the woods. To my left, the canoe lake glittered, and the climbing wall glowed from the lava pouring down its side. 12 cabins, one for each Olympian god, made a horseshoe pattern around the commons area. Farther south were the strawberry fields, the armory, and the 4-story big house with its sky-blue paint job and its bronze eagle weather vane. In some ways, the camp hadn't changed, but you couldn't see the war by looking at the buildings or the fields. You could see it in the faces of the demigods and satyrs and naiads coming up the hill. There weren't as many at camp as 4 summers ago. Some had left and never come back. Some had died fighting. Others, we tried not to talk about them, had gone over to the enemy. the ones who were still here were battle-hardened and weary. There was little laughter at camp these days. Even the Hermes cabin didn't play so many pranks. It's hard to enjoy practical jokes when your whole life feels like one. Chiron galloped into the pavilion first, which was easy for him since he's a white stallion from the waist down. His beard had grown wilder over the summer. He wore a green t-shirt that said, "My other car is a centaur," and a bow slung over his back. "Percy," he said, "thank the gods. But where?" Annabeth ran in right behind him, and I'll admit, my heart did a little relay race in my chest when I saw her. It's not that she tried to look good. We'd been doing so many combat missions lately, she hardly brushed her curly blonde hair anymore, and she didn't care what clothes she was wearing. Usually the same old orange camp t-shirt and jeans, and once in a while, her bronze armor. Her eyes were stormy gray. Most of the time, we couldn't get through a conversation without trying to strangle each other. Still, just seeing her made me feel fuzzy in the head. Last summer, before Luke had turned into Kronos and everything went sour, there had been a few times when I thought maybe, well, that we might get past the strangle each other phase. "What happened?" She grabbed my arm. "Is Luke..." "The ship blew up," I said. "He wasn't destroyed. I don't know where..." Selena Beauregard pushed through the crowd. Her hair wasn't combed, and she wasn't even wearing makeup, which wasn't like her. "Where's Charlie?" she demanded, looking around like he might be hiding. I glanced at Chiron helplessly. The old centaur cleared his throat.
"Selena, my dear, let's talk about this at the big house."
"No," she muttered. "No, no." She started to cry, and the rest of us stood around, too stunned to speak. We'd already lost so many people over the summer, but this was the worst. With Beckendorf gone, it felt like someone had stolen the anchor for the entire camp. Finally, Clarice from the Ares cabin came forward. She put her arm around Selena. They had one of the strangest friendships ever. A daughter of the war god and a daughter of the love goddess. But ever since Selena had given Clarice advice last summer about her first boyfriend, Clarice had decided she was Selena's personal bodyguard. Clarice was dressed in her blood-red combat armor, her brown hair tucked into a bandana. She was as big and beefy as a rugby player, with a permanent scowl on her face, but she spoke gently to Selena. "Come on, girl," she said. "Let's get to the big house. I'll make you some hot chocolate." Everyone turned and wandered off in twos and threes, heading back to the cabins. Nobody was excited to see me now. Nobody wanted to hear about the blown-up ship. Only Annabeth and Chiron stayed behind. Annabeth wiped a tear from her cheek. "I'm glad you're not dead, seaweed brain."
"Thanks," I said.
"Me too." Chiron put a hand on my shoulder.
"I'm sure you did everything you could, Percy. Will you tell us what happened?"
I didn't want to go through it again, but I told them the story, including my dream about the Titans. I left out the detail about Nico. Nico had made me promise not to tell anybody about his plan until I made up my mind, and the plan was so scary, I didn't mind keeping it a secret. Chiron gazed down at the valley.
"We must call a war council immediately to discuss this spy and other matters."
"Poseidon mentioned another threat," I said, "something even bigger than the Princess Andromeda. I thought it might be that challenge the Titan had mentioned in my dream." Chiron and Annabeth exchanged looks, like they knew something I didn't. I hated when they did that.
"We will discuss that also," Chiron promised.
"One more thing." I took a deep breath. "When I talked to my father, he said to tell you it's time. I need to know the full prophecy." Chiron's shoulders sagged, but he didn't look surprised.
"I've dreaded this day. Very well, Annabeth. We will show Percy the truth. All of it. Let's go to the attic.
I'd been to the big house attic 3 times before, which was 3 times more than I wanted to. A ladder led up from the top of the staircase. I wondered how Chiron was going to get up there, being half horse and all, but he didn't try.
"You know where it is," he told Annabeth. "Bring it down, please."
Annabeth nodded. "Come on, Percy." The sun was setting outside, so the attic was even darker and creepier than usual. Old hero trophies were stacked everywhere. Dented shields, pickled heads in jars from various monsters, a pair of fuzzy dice on a bronze plaque that read, "Stolen from Chrysaor's Honda Civic by Gus, son of Hermes, 1988. I picked up a curved bronze sword so badly bent it looked like the letter M. I could still see green stains on the metal from the magical poison that used to cover it. The tag was dated last summer. It read, "Scimitar of Campe, destroyed in the Battle of the Labyrinth." "You remember Briara's throwing those boulders?" I asked. Annabeth gave me a grudging smile. "And Grover causing a panic?" We locked eyes. I thought of a different time last summer, under Mount St. Helens, when Annabeth thought I was gonna die, and she kissed me. She cleared her throat and looked away. "Prophecy!" "Right." I put down the scimitar. "Prophecy." We walked over to the window. On a 3-legged stool sat the Oracle, a shriveled female mummy in a tie-dye dress. Tufts of black hair clung to her skull. Glassy eyes stared out of her leathery face. Just looking at her made my skin crawl. If you wanted to leave camp during the summer, it used to be you had to come up here to get a quest. This summer, that rule had been tossed. Campers left all the time on combat missions. We had no choice if we wanted to stop Kronos. Still, I remembered too well the strange green mist, the spirit of the Oracle, that lived inside the mummy. She looked lifeless now, but whenever she spoke a prophecy, she moved. Sometimes fog gushed out of her mouth and created strange shapes. Once, she'd even left the attic and taken a little zombie stroll into the woods to deliver a message. I wasn't sure what she'd do for the great prophecy. I half expected her to start tap dancing or something. But she just sat there like she was dead, which she was. "I never understood this," I whispered. "What?" Annabeth asked. "Why, it's a mummy." "Percy, she didn't used to be a mummy. For thousands of years, the spirit of the Oracle lived inside a beautiful maiden. The spirit would be passed on from generation to generation. Chiron told me she was like that 50 years ago." Annabeth pointed at the mummy. "But she was the last. What happened?" Annabeth started to say something, then apparently changed her mind. "Let's just do our job and get out of here." I looked nervously at the Oracle's withered face. "So, what now?" Annabeth approached the mummy and held out her palms. "Oh, Oracle, the time is at hand. I ask for the great prophecy." I braced myself, but the mummy didn't move. Instead, Annabeth approached and unclasped one of its necklaces. I'd never paid too much attention to its jewelry before. I figured it was just hippie love beads and stuff. But when Annabeth turned toward me, she was holding a leather pouch, like a Native American medicine pouch on a cord braided with feathers. She opened the bag and took out a roll of parchment no bigger than her pinky. "No way," I said. "You mean all these years I've been asking about this stupid prophecy and it's been right there around her neck?" "The time wasn't right," Annabeth said. "Believe me, Percy, I read this when I was 10 years old and I still have nightmares about it." "Great," I said. "Can I read it now?" "Downstairs at the War Council," Annabeth said. "Not in front of... you know..." I looked at the glassy eyes of the Oracle, and I decided not to argue. We headed downstairs to join the others. I didn't know it then, but it would be the last time I ever visited the attic. The senior counselors had gathered around the ping-pong table. Don't ask me why, but the rec room had become the camp's informal headquarters for war councils. When Annabeth, Kyron, and I came in, though, it looked more like a shouting match. Clarice was still in full battle gear. Her electric spear was strapped to her back. Actually, her second electric spear, since I'd broken the first one. She called the spear Mamer. Behind her back, everybody else called it Lamer. She had her boar-shaped helmet under one arm and a knife at her belt. She was in the midst of yelling at Michael Yu, the new head counselor for Apollo, which looked kind of funny since Clarice was a foot taller. Michael had taken over the Apollo cabin after Lee Fletcher died in battle last summer. Michael stood 4'6", with another 2 feet of attitude. He reminded me of a ferret, with a pointy nose and scrunched-up features, either because he scowled so much or because he spent too much time looking down the shaft of an arrow. "It's our loot!" he yelled, standing on his tiptoes so he could get in Clarice's face. "If you don't like it, you can kiss my quiver!" Around the table, people were trying not to laugh. The Stoll brothers, Pollux from the Dionysus cabin, Katie Gardner from Demeter, even Jake Mason, the hastily appointed new counselor from Hephaestus, managed a faint smile. Only Selena Beauregard didn't pay any attention. She sat beside Clarice and stared vacantly at the ping-pong net. Her eyes were red and puffy. A cup of hot chocolate sat untouched in front of her. It seemed unfair that she had to be here. I couldn't believe Clarice and Michael standing over her, arguing about something as stupid as loot when she just lost Beckendorf. "Stop it!" I yelled. "What are you guys doing?" Clarice glowered at me. "Tell Michael not to be a selfish jerk." "Oh, that's perfect coming from you," Michael said. "The only reason I'm here is to support Selena," Clarice shouted. "Otherwise, I'd be back in my cabin." "What are you talking about?" I demanded. Pollux cleared his throat.
"Clarice has refused to speak to any of us until her, issue is resolved. She hasn't spoken for 3 days."
"It's been wonderful," Travis Stoll said wistfully. "What issue?" I asked. Clarice turned to Kyron. "You're in charge, right? Does my cabin get what we want or not?" Kyron shuffled his hooves.
"My dear, as I've already explained, Michael is correct. Apollo's cabin has the best claim. Besides, we have more important matters."
"Sure," Clarice snapped. "Always more important matters than what Ares needs. We're just supposed to show up and fight when you need us and not complain."
"That would be nice," Connor Stoll muttered.
Clarice gripped her knife. "Maybe I should ask Mr. D."
"As you know,"
Kyron interrupted, his tone slightly angry now.
"Our director Dionysus is busy with the war. He can't be bothered with this."
"I see," Clarice said. "And the senior counselors, are any of you gonna side with me?" Nobody was smiling now. None of them met Clarice's eyes. "Fine." Clarice turned to Selena. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get into this when you've just lost. Anyway, I apologize. To you, nobody else." Selena didn't seem to register her words. Clarice threw her knife on the ping-pong table. "All of you can fight this war without Ares. Until I get satisfaction, no one in my cabin is lifting a finger to help. Have fun dying!" The counselors were all too stunned to say anything as Clarice stormed out of the room. Finally, Michael Yu said, "Good riddance." "Are you kidding?" Katie Gardner protested. "This is a disaster."
"She can't be serious," Travis said. "Can she?"
Kyron sighed.
Her pride has been wounded. She'll calm down eventually.
But he didn't sound convinced. I wanted to ask what the heck Clarice was so mad about, but I looked at Annabeth, and she mouthed the words, "I'll tell you later."
"Now," Chiron continued, "if you please, counselors, Percy has brought something I think you should hear. Percy, the great prophecy."
Annabeth handed me the parchment. It felt dry and old, and my fingers fumbled with the string. I uncurled the paper, trying not to rip it, and began to read. "A half-blood of the eldest dogs..." "Percy," Annabeth interrupted, "that's gods, not dogs." "Oh, right," I said. Being dyslexic is one mark of a demigod, but sometimes I really hate it. The more nervous I am, the worse my reading gets. "A half-blood of the eldest gods shall reach 16 against all odds." I hesitated, staring at the next lines. A cold feeling started in my fingers as if the paper was freezing. "And see the world in endless sleep, the hero's soul, cursed blade shall reap." Suddenly, Riptide seemed heavier in my pocket. A cursed blade? Chiron once told me Riptide had brought many people sorrow. Was it possible my own sword could get me killed? And how could the world fall into endless sleep, unless that meant death?
"Percy," Chiron urged, "read the rest."
My mouth felt like it was full of sand, but I spoke the last two lines. "A single choice shall end his days, Olympus to pursue. "Preserve," Annabeth said gently. "It means to save." "I know what it means," I grumbled. "Olympus to preserve or raise." The room was silent. Finally, Connor Stoll said, "Raise is good, isn't it?" "Not raise," Selena said. Her voice was hollow, but I was startled to hear her speak at all. "R-A-Z-E means destroy." "Obliterate," Annabeth said. "Annihilate. Turn to rubble." "Got it." My heart felt like lead. "Thanks." Everybody was looking at me, with concern or pity, or maybe a little fear. Chiron closed his eyes as if he were saying a prayer. In horse form, his head almost brushed the lights in the rec room.
"You see now, Percy, why we thought it best not to tell you the whole prophecy. You've had enough on your shoulders."
"Without realizing I was going to die in the end anyway?" I said. "Yeah, I get it." Chiron gazed at me sadly. The guy was 3,000 years old. He'd seen hundreds of heroes die. He might not like it, but he was used to it. He probably knew better than to try to reassure me. "Percy," Annabeth said, "you know prophecies always have double meanings. It might not literally mean you die."
"Sure," I said. "A single choice shall end his days. That has tons of meanings, right?"
"Maybe we can stop it," Jake Mason offered. "The hero's soul, cursed blade shall reap. Maybe we could find this cursed blade and destroy it. Sounds like Kronos' scythe, right?"
I hadn't thought about that, but it didn't matter if the cursed blade was Riptide or Kronos' scythe. Either way, I doubted we could stop the prophecy. A blade was supposed to reap my soul. As a general rule, I preferred not to have my soul reaped.
"Perhaps we should let Percy think about these lines," Chiron said. "He needs time."
"No." I folded up the prophecy and shoved it into my pocket. I felt defiant and angry, though I wasn't sure who I was angry with. "I don't need time. If I die, I die. I can't worry about that, right? Annabeth's hands were shaking a little. She wouldn't meet my eyes. Let's move on, I said. We've got other problems. We've got a spy. Michael Yu scowled.
A spy?
I told them what had happened on the Princess Andromeda, how Kronos had known we were coming, how he'd shown me the silver scythe pendant he'd used to communicate with someone at camp. Selena started to cry again, and Annabeth put an arm around her shoulders.
Well, Connor Stoll said uncomfortably, we've suspected there might be a spy for years, right? Somebody kept passing information to Luke, like the location of the Golden Fleece a couple of years ago. It must be somebody who knew him well.
Maybe subconsciously, he glanced at Annabeth. She'd known Luke better than anyone, of course, but Connor looked away quickly.
It could be anybody.
Yes. Katie Gardner frowned at the Stoll brothers. She disliked them ever since they decorated the grass roof of the Demeter cabin with chocolate Easter bunnies.
Like one of Luke's siblings.
Travis and Connor both started arguing with her.
Stop!
Selena banged the table so hard her hot chocolate spilled.
Charlie's dead and you're all arguing like little kids.
She put her head down and began to sob. Hot chocolate trickled off the ping-pong table. Everybody looked ashamed.
She's right,
Pollock said at last.
Accusing each other doesn't help. We need to keep our eyes open for a silver necklace with a scythe charm. If Kronos had one, the spy probably does too.
Michael Yu grunted.
We need to find this spy before we plan our next operation. Blowing up the Princess Andromeda won't stop Kronos forever.
No, indeed, Chiron said. In fact, his next assault is already on the way.
I scowled. You mean the bigger threat Poseidon mentioned? He and Annabeth looked at each other like, it's time. Did I mention? I hate it when they do that.
Percy, Chiron said, we didn't want to tell you until you returned to camp. You needed a break with your mortal friends.
Annabeth blushed. It dawned on me that she knew I'd been hanging out with Rachel, and I felt guilty. Then I felt angry that I felt guilty. I was allowed to have friends outside camp, right? It wasn't like, tell me what's happened, I said. Chiron picked up a bronze goblet from the snack table. He tossed water onto the hot plate where we usually melted nacho cheese. Steam billowed up, making a rainbow in the fluorescent lights. Chiron fished a golden drachma out of his pouch, tossed it through the mist, and muttered,
O Iris, goddess of the rainbow, show us the threat.
The mist shimmered. I saw the familiar image of a smoldering volcano, Mount St. Helens. As I watched, the side of the mountain exploded. Fire, ash, and lava rolled out. A newscaster's voice was saying, even larger than last year's eruption, and geologists warn that the mountain may not be done. I knew all about last year's eruption. I'd caused it. But this explosion was much worse. The mountain tore itself apart, collapsing inward, and an enormous form rose out of the smoke and lava like it was emerging from a manhole. I hoped the mist would keep the humans from seeing it clearly, because what I saw would have caused panic and riots across the entire United States. The giant was bigger than anything I'd ever encountered. Even my demigod eyes couldn't make out its exact form through the ash and fire, but it was vaguely humanoid and so huge it could have used the Chrysler Building as a baseball bat. The mountain shook with a horrible rumbling, as if the monster were laughing. It's him, I said. Typhon! I was seriously hoping Chiron would say something good like,
No, that's our huge friend Leroy. He's going to help us.
But no such luck. He simply nodded.
The most horrible monster of all. The biggest single threat the gods ever faced. He has been freed from under the mountain at last. But this scene is from 2 days ago. Here is what is happening today.
Chiron waved his hand, and the image changed. I saw a bank of storm clouds rolling across the Midwest plains. Lightning flickered, lines of tornadoes destroyed everything in their path, ripping up houses and trailers, tossing cars around like matchbox toys.
"Monumental floods," an announcer was saying. 5 states declared disaster areas as the freak storm system sweeps east, continuing its path of destruction.
The camera zoomed in on a column of storm bearing down on some Midwest city. I couldn't tell which one. Inside the storm, I could see the giant, just small glimpses of his true form, a smoky arm, a dark clawed hand the size of a city block. His angry roar rolled across the plains like a nuclear blast. Other smaller forms darted through the clouds, circling the monster. I saw flashes of light, and I realized the giant was trying to swat them. I squinted and thought I saw a golden chariot flying into the blackness. Then, some kind of huge bird, a monstrous owl, dived in to attack the giant. "Are those the gods?" I said.
"Yes, Percy," Chiron said. "They have been fighting him for days now, trying to slow him down. But Typhon is marching forward, toward New York, toward Olympus."
I let that sink in. How long until he gets here?
"Unless the gods can stop him, perhaps 5 days. Most of the Olympians are there, except for your father, who has a war of his own to fight."
"But then who's guarding Olympus?"
Connor Stoll shook his head. "If Typhon gets to New York, it won't matter who's guarding Olympus."
I thought about Kronos' words on the ship. "I would love to see the terror in your eyes when you realize how I will destroy Olympus." Was this what he was talking about? An attack by Typhon? It was sure terrifying enough. But Kronos was always fooling us, misdirecting our attention. This seemed too obvious for him, and in my dream, the Golden Titan had talked about several more challenges to come, as if Typhon were only the first. "It's a trick," I said. "We have to warn the gods. Something else is going to happen." Chiron looked at me gravely.
"Something worse than Typhon? I hope not."
"We have to defend Olympus," I insisted. "Kronos has another attack planned."
"He did," Travis Stoll reminded me. "But you sunk his ship."
Everyone was looking at me. They wanted some good news. They wanted to believe that at least I'd given them a little bit of hope. I glanced at Annabeth. I could tell we were thinking the same thing. What if the Princess Andromeda was a ploy? What if Kronos let us blow up that ship so we'd lower our guard? But I wasn't going to say that in front of Selena. Her boyfriend had sacrificed himself for that mission.
"Maybe you're right,"
I said, though I didn't believe it. I tried to imagine how things could get much worse. The gods were in the Midwest fighting a huge monster that had almost defeated them once before. Poseidon was under siege and losing the war against the sea titan Oceanus. Kronos was still out there somewhere. Olympus was virtually undefended. The demigods of Camp Half-Blood were on our own with a spy in our midst. Oh, and according to the ancient prophecy, I was going to die when I turned 16, which happened to be in 5 days, the exact time Typhon was supposed to hit New York. Almost forgot that.
"Well," Chiron said, "I think that's enough for one night."
He waved his hand, and the steam dissipated. The stormy battle of Typhon and the gods disappeared. "That's an understatement," I muttered, and the war council adjourned. Chapter 4. We Burn a Metal Shroud. I dreamed Rachel Elizabeth Dare was throwing darts at my picture. She was standing in her room. Okay, back up. I have to explain that Rachel doesn't have a room. She has the top floor of her family's mansion, which is a renovated brownstone in Brooklyn, Her room is a huge loft with industrial lighting and floor-to-ceiling windows. It's about twice as big as my mom's apartment. Some alt rock was blaring from her paint-covered Bose docking system. As far as I could tell, Rachel's only rule about music was that no two songs on her iPod could sound the same, and they all had to be strange. She wore a kimono, and her hair was frizzy like she'd been sleeping. Her bed was messed up. Sheets hung over a bunch of artist's easels. Dirty clothes and old energy bar wrappers were strewn around the floor. But when you've got a room that big, the mess doesn't look so bad. Out the windows, you could see the entire nighttime skyline of Manhattan. The picture she was attacking was a painting of me standing over the giant Antaeus. Rachel had painted it a couple of months ago. My expression in the picture was fierce, disturbing even, so it was hard to tell if I was the good guy or the bad guy, but Rachel said I'd look just like that after the battle. "Demigods," Rachel muttered as she threw another dart at the canvas, "and their stupid quests." Most of the darts bounced off, but a few stuck. One hung off my chin like a goatee. Someone pounded on her bedroom door.
"Rachel," a man shouted, "what in the world are you doing? Turn off that—"
Rachel scooped up her remote control and shut off the music. "Come in." Her dad walked in, scowling and blinking from the light. He had rust-colored hair, a little darker than Rachel's. It was smushed on one side like he'd lost a fight with his pillow. His blue silk pajamas had WD monogrammed on the pocket. Seriously, who has monogrammed pajamas?
"What's going on?" he demanded. "It's 3 in the morning.
"Couldn't sleep," Rachel said. On the painting, a dart fell off my face. Rachel hid the rest behind her back, but Mr. Dare noticed.
"So, I take it your friend isn't coming to St. Thomas?"
That's what Mr. Dare called me. Never Percy, just your friend, or young man, if he was talking to me, which he rarely did. Rachel knit her eyebrows. "I don't know."
"We leave in the morning," her dad said. "If he hasn't made up his mind yet..."
"He's probably not coming," Rachel said miserably. "Happy?" Mr. Dare put his hands behind his back. He paced the room with a stern expression. I imagined he did that in the boardroom of his land development company and made his employees nervous.
"Are you still having bad dreams?"
he asked.
"Headaches?"
Rachel threw her darts on the floor. "I should never have told you about that."
"I'm your father," he said. "I'm worried about you."
"Worried about the family's reputation," Rachel muttered. Her father didn't react. Maybe because he'd heard that comment before, or maybe because it was true.
"We could call Dr. Arkwright," he suggested. "He helped you get through the death of your hamster."
"I was 6 then," she said. "And no, Dad, I don't need a therapist. I just..." She shook her head helplessly. Her father stopped in front of the windows. He gazed at the New York skyline as if he owned it, which wasn't true. He only owned part of it.
"It will be good for you to get away," he decided. "You've had some unhealthy influences."
"I'm not going to Clarion Ladies Academy," Rachel said, "and my friends are none of your business." Mr. Dare smiled, but it wasn't a warm smile. It was more like, "Someday you'll realize how silly you sound."
"Try to get some sleep," he urged. "We'll be at the beach by tomorrow night. It will be fun."
"Fun," Rachel repeated. "Lots of fun." Her father exited the room. He left the door open behind him. Rachel stared at the portrait of me. Then she walked to the easel next to it, which was covered in a sheet. "I hope they're dreams," she said. She uncovered the easel.
On it was a hastily sketched charcoal, but Rachel was a good artist. The picture was definitely Luke as a young boy. He was about 9 years old, with a wide grin and no scar on his face. I had no idea how Rachel could have known what he looked like back then, but the portrait was so good, I had a feeling she wasn't guessing. From what I knew about Luke's life, which wasn't much, the picture showed him just before he'd found out he was a half-blood and had run away from home. Rachel stared at the portrait. Then she uncovered the next easel. This picture was even more disturbing. It showed the Empire State Building with lightning all around it. In the distance, a dark storm was brewing, with a huge hand coming out of the clouds. At the base of the building, a crowd had gathered. But it wasn't a normal crowd of tourists and pedestrians. I saw spears, javelins, and banners, the trappings of an army. "Percy," Rachel muttered, as if she knew I was listening. "What is going on?" The dream faded, and the last thing I remember was wishing I could answer her question. The next morning, I wanted to call her, but there were no phones at camp. Dionysus and Chiron didn't need a landline. They just called Olympus with an iris message whenever they needed something, and when demigods use cell phones, the signals agitate every monster within 100 miles. It's like sending up a flare. "Here I am. Please rearrange my face." Even within the safe borders of camp, that's not the kind of advertising we wanted to do. Most demigods, except for Annabeth and a few others, don't even own cell phones. And I definitely couldn't tell Annabeth, "Hey, let me borrow your phone so I can call Rachel." To make the call, I would have had to leave camp and walk several miles to the nearest convenience store. Even if Chiron let me go, by the time I got there, Rachel would have been on the plane to St. Thomas. I ate a depressing breakfast by myself at the Poseidon table. I kept staring at the fissure in the marble floor where 2 years ago, Nico had banished a bunch of bloodthirsty skeletons to the underworld. The memory didn't exactly improve my appetite. After breakfast, Annabeth and I walked down to inspect the cabins. Actually, it was Annabeth's turn for inspection. My morning chore was to sort through reports for Chiron, but since we both hated our jobs, we decided to do them together so it wouldn't be so heinous. We started at the Poseidon cabin, which was basically just me. I'd made my bunk bed that morning, well, sort of, and straightened the minotaur horn on the wall, so I gave myself a 4 out of 5. Annabeth made a face. "You're being generous." She used the end of her pencil to pick up an old pair of running shorts. I snatched them away. "Hey, give me a break. I don't have Tyson cleaning up after me this summer." 3 out of 5, Annabeth said. I knew better than to argue, so we moved along. I tried to skim through Chiron's stack of reports as we walked. There were messages from demigods, nature spirits, and satyrs all around the country writing about the latest monster activity. They were pretty depressing, and my ADHD brain did not like concentrating on depressing stuff. Little battles were raging everywhere. Camp recruitment was down to zero. Satyrs were having trouble finding new demigods and bringing them to Half-Blood Hill because so many monsters were roaming the country. Our friend Thalia, who led the Hunters of Artemis, hadn't been heard from in months, and if Artemis knew what had happened to them, she wasn't sharing information. We visited the Aphrodite cabin, which of course got a 5 out of 5. The beds were perfectly made. The clothes in everyone's footlockers were color-coordinated. Fresh flowers bloomed on the windowsills. I wanted to dock a point because the whole place reeked of designer perfume, but Annabeth ignored me. "Great job as usual, Selena," Annabeth said. Selena nodded listlessly. The wall behind her bed was decorated with pictures of Beckendorf. She sat on her bunk with a box of chocolates on her lap, and I remembered that her dad owned a chocolate store in the village, which was how he'd caught the attention of Aphrodite. "You want a bonbon?" Selena asked. "My dad sent them. He thought, He thought they might cheer me up.
Are they any good? I asked.
She shook her head.
They taste like cardboard.
I didn't have anything against cardboard, so I tried one.
Annabeth passed.
We promised to see Selena later and kept going. As we crossed the commons area, a fight broke out between the Ares and Apollo cabins. Some Apollo campers, armed with firebombs, flew over the Ares cabin in a chariot pulled by two Pegasi. I'd never seen the chariot before, but it looked like a pretty sweet ride. Soon, the roof of the Ares cabin was burning, and naiads from the canoe lake rushed over to blow water on it. Then the Ares campers called down a curse, and all the Apollo kids' arrows turned to rubber. The Apollo kids kept shooting at the Ares kids, but the arrows bounced off. Two archers ran by, chased by an angry Ares kid who was yelling in poetry.
Curse me, eh? I'll make you pay. I don't want to rhyme all day.
Annabeth sighed. Not that again. Last time Apollo cursed a cabin, it took a week for the rhyming couplets to wear off. I shuddered. Apollo was god of poetry as well as archery, and I'd heard him recite in person. I'd almost rather get shot by an arrow. What are they fighting about anyway? I asked. Annabeth ignored me while she scribbled on her inspection scroll, giving both cabins a 1 out of 5. I found myself staring at her, which was stupid since I'd seen her a billion times. She and I were about the same height this summer, which was a relief. Still, she seemed so much more mature. It was kind of intimidating. I mean, sure, she'd always been cute, but she was starting to be seriously beautiful. Finally, she said, "That flying chariot?"
"What?"
"You asked what they were fighting about."
"Oh, right. They captured it in a raid in Philadelphia last week. Some of Luke's demigods were there with that flying chariot. The Apollo cabin seized it during the battle, but the Ares cabin led the raid, so they've been fighting about who gets it ever since."
We ducked as Michael Yu's chariot dive-bombed an Ares camper. The Ares camper tried to stab him and cuss him out in rhyming couplets. He was pretty creative about rhyming those cuss words. "We're fighting for our lives," I said, "and they're bickering about some stupid chariot."
"They'll get over it," Annabeth said. "Clarice will come to her senses."
I wasn't so sure. That didn't sound like the Clarice I knew. I scanned more reports, and we inspected a few more cabins. Demeter got a 4. Hephaestus got a 3 and probably should have gotten lower, but with Beckendorf being gone and all, we cut them some slack. Hermes got a 2, which was no surprise. All campers who didn't know their godly parentage were shoved into the Hermes cabin, and since the gods were kind of forgetful, that cabin was always overcrowded. Finally, we got to Athena's cabin, which was orderly and clean as usual. Books were straightened on the shelves, the armor was polished, battle maps and blueprints decorated the walls. Only Annabeth's bunk was messy. It was covered in papers, and her silver laptop was still running.
"Vlachus," Annabeth muttered, which was basically calling herself an idiot in Greek.
Her second-in-command, Malcolm, suppressed a smile.
"Yeah, we cleaned everything else. Didn't know if it was safe to move your notes."
That was probably smart. Annabeth had a bronze knife that she reserved just for monsters and people who messed with her stuff. Malcolm grinned at me.
"We'll wait outside while you finish inspection."
The Athena campers filed out the door while Annabeth cleaned up her bunk. I shuffled uneasily and pretended to go through some more reports. Technically, even on inspection, it was against camp rules for two campers to be, like, alone in a cabin. That rule had come up a lot when Selena and Beckendorf started dating, and I know some of you might be thinking, aren't all demigods related on the godly side, and doesn't that make dating gross? But the thing is, the godly side of your family doesn't count, genetically speaking, since gods don't have DNA. A demigod would never think about dating someone who had the same godly parent. Like two kids from Athena cabin? No way. But a daughter of Aphrodite and a son of Hephaestus? They're not related, so it's no problem.